Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
It's just that perfect mix of being quite gruesome but not actually that terrifying but still fascinating, and they're both brilliant, and it's so funny as well.
It never feels choppy, it never feels weird, it never loses you, it just clips along. It's great. It's like a cartoon with consequences. It is a good fun time, and it is kind of watching a sea of incredibly talented actors just run with it.
It kind of fits everything. It's a comedy, it's got some really weird horror element. It's quite a good gateway horror film for maybe young horror fans. And if you want to see Bruce Willis just being a total shaking wreck, this is the one to do it.
Hey everybody, joining us in the studio, we've got Emma.
Hi.
Paul.
Hello there.
And as always, Kobe.
Hello.
And we're here to review Death Becomes Her.
Thank you, as always, to the Mighty People for the mighty, mighty tunes. And thanks to Ben from Rockwood Audio for his awesome editing skills.
Please do remember to write a review and rate us on Apple Podcasts and anywhere you can do where you listen to the podcast, because it really does help us.
And you can join in the conversation with us on Twitter
at FlixWatcherPod and on Instagram
at FlixWatcher.
Hello film fans, joining FlixWatcher remotely today we have Emma and Paul. If you could please say hello and tell our guests a little bit more about who you are and the podcast you do, please.
I am Paul, and well, she is Emma, and we are the Yearbook Committee podcast. We are a podcast all about teen movies, in which every episode we try and pick some sort of theme or topic about sort of teen life, or at least as far as it's represented in film, and then we pick three films that line themselves up with that, and then we talk about how good those films are, how good they are representing that topic. And yeah, it's a good time, and we churn through a lot of movies with that kind of format.
It's getting an unhealthy number already.
Yeah, I mean, we started, like, our spreadsheet that we get all of, that we made a list of, is an absurd number because there are an absurd amount of teen movies out there. So yeah, we'll never really run out of material on that
I
level.
Mean, and they keep making them.
They keep making them, you know.
Yeah, because you had recent ones such as Booksmart in the...
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
we've done Booksmart, which is an absolute smasher.
Yeah, I could watch that right now. That's a great movie.
Let's just go watch Booksmart.
Wait, hold on.
You've done Booksmart already, haven't you?
We have indeed. Have you listened to
that episode? We've done quite a few teen movies, haven't we?
Yeah. I went in it was like, Center Stage. You know what? Listen to that one.
Oh yeah, we did Center Stage as well.
Oh, did you? What was the linking theme for Center Stage?
The Stage School Kids.
Kind of the drama kids. So it was like we watched Center Stage, Fame, and Raise Your Voice. Fame is the shit. It's
Fame's
so
great.
Good.
I'll never stop going on about how much I love Fame.
So, Paul, you didn't like Fame?
Oh no, it's great. Fame is really good. Like, good songs, an amazing one shot at a train station that I wouldn't shut up about. Still won't shut up about, clearly. Fame's good stuff.
Yeah, I remember being, randomly, it's a film I watched loads as a kid and loved the song.
Yeah, I was the same. I feel like I watched it far too young, because every now and then when you watch it as an adult, you're like, this is quite grown up at times, and I watched this at like seven.
It is, it's one of the scenes like, Mum, why was I watching this? There's dancing, Kobe, you know.
I don't think it's in my memory. I don't think I've seen it, or at least...
That's a good time.
Not all the way through.
It heavily influenced Center Stage and other kind of things that followed it. Well, thanks for joining us, guys. The Yearbook Podcast is a great listen. Do check it out. Bob, Paul, you also have another podcast. Do you want to tell us briefly about that before we head into talking about this film today?
I'm also one quarter of Fatal Attractions, which is a podcast all about initially 90s erotic thrillers, but then we opened up a little bit and now we're looking to erotic thrillers of all decades. So we're covering quite the gamut. So it's Fatal Attraction, it's Basic Instinct, it's Body Double, Perfect Blue. There's all kinds of really good stuff that we cover. And not
when
so
you say
good
really
stuff.
Good stuff, I mean, do you find yourself hanging your head in shame sometimes when you think, oh, fucking hell, this will...
Oh, legit, there's some stuff in there that's absolute garbage and should never be watched by anyone. But we try and balance that out. You know, for again, for every like something like Wild Orchid, garbage, actual trash, there is a Perfect Blue or Eyes Wide Shut or Bound or something that's just glorious.
Yeah, we've had Amelie on here, who brought us La La Land, which Helen was not happy about in any way, shape or form.
I love La La Land.
But that, not happy with La La Land before Amelie decided to bring it.
There's she wasn't the deciding factor in you not liking it.
I should add.
Yeah, do go back to listen to La La Land if you want to hear what another member of the Fatal Attraction pod. But we're here to talk today about Death Becomes It, which is your choice, Emma.
Yep.
So can you tell us first of all why you chose it, and then you'll have 60 seconds or less.
So first of all, I think Death Becomes It because, again, it's another film I probably watched far too young. I love it to bits. It's so goth, it's camp, it's PG body horror. and the cast's amazing as well, and I'll get into this more, but there's absolutely nothing for me not to like about it.
Okay, synopsis starting now.
Two rivals discover the potion of eternal youth and are just horrible to each other for the rest of their lives. Done in 10.
Well done. Love it.
Goldie Hawn and Meryl Streep are basically two like school friends. I think they went to school together, but over the years they've just grown this like really hideous rivalry where everything they do is really to outdo each other, and Bruce Willis is the sort of hapless idiot caught between the two of them, just sort of bouncing from pillar to post occasionally, literally.
It's such a great role for Willis actually, because this is so against type.
It's so different, and especially like this was like 1992, so he was still doing like loads of action movies. I mean, not like he's not now, like he's still popping up every now and then, even though he should probably take a nap. Like at this point in time he was doing loads and loads of big actiony things, whereas this is a total quiet character. He's a pushover, total doormat, and it's just great to see him being a quivering wreck for a change. Loved it.
What do you think he took it? Was it, do you reckon it was Robert Zemeckis said, hey, I've got a film for you, and it's like, yeah, I'll be in a film.
I've got no idea, but it was a great choice for him to do it anyway. Maybe he just wanted a wee break. Maybe it just felt like fun, because I think that's one of the real strengths of the film, is that it's not too serious. It knows that it's kind of daft at times, but I think that's kind of what's magic about it. So I think maybe everybody, like, they certainly look like they're having a good time.
Where are you in this, Paul?
I really enjoyed Death Becomes Her. I actually saw this one in the cinema. So I was 10 when I saw this one. And yeah, exactly that. It's a great time. I mean, like, as you say, it really demonstrates how good Bruce Willis can be when he's awake. And to have people like Meryl Streep and Goldie Hawn just channeling some proper like old Hollywood style feuding just into like hyper glamorous bitchiness with shovels. God damn, that's like, how can you not like that? That's a great time.
It's just no holds barred as well. Like, it's really vicious. It's really nasty at times, both verbally and physically.
I'm very jealous that you got to see it at the cinema. I also saw this when I was younger and absolutely adored it. It's just that perfect mix of being quite gruesome but not actually that terrifying but still fascinating, and they're both brilliant, and it's so funny as well. There's one of my favorite lines is when Madeline and Bruce Willis are in the car. I can't remember Bruce Willis's character's name. What's his character's name? Ernest, that's it. And she just says to him, could you just not breathe? And it's just, it's brilliant, it's fantastic. It's an Oscar winner. Won the Oscar, rightly so, for best visual effects, and it's brilliant, and it's so sprightly, and it's like a zombie movie, except no one ever talks about them being actual zombies, and yeah, it's brilliant. I love it. I love the dresses they wear, and Isabella Rossellini is like bejeweled, barely covering her.
It's getting held up through just sheer willpower. That's the only way that's staying on her. It's amazing. And there's a point where she takes a pen out of it. Where was she keeping that?
Yeah, I saw this at the cinema as well. And So I was 12 and I saw it. I think, I'm not sure if it was Bruce Willis I went to see it for or Goldie Hawn, who I was probably a bigger fan of at the time. But I just didn't understand it at all. This film made no sense to me whatsoever as a 12-year-old. For me, I think it totally makes more sense as an adult. So I was interested to hear you, Paul, say when you saw it at cinema at 10 that you vibed off it. Yeah. And this, for me, at the time, I don't think I would have registered that Robert Zemeckis was the director who's behind my favourite films at the time, Back to the Future and like Who Framed Roger Rabbit. I don't think that would have been a driver for me to see it. But I think I just remember being advertised everywhere and some of the scenes being funny. But for me, I think the whole kind of story is super dark. And as a kid, I was like, sorry, what's going on here? This is really weird, Dad.
Why did you bring me here?
But as an adult, it really ties in together. It really ties in all the pieces together. So I don't think this is a kid's film. Well, for me, it wasn't a kid's film to get the most out of it. In the same way that I saw Parenthood with Goldie Hawn and Steve Martin, didn't get that as a kid. But I love both Steve Martin and Goldie Hawn and The House Sitter. Sorry, The House Sitter was Goldie Hawn and Steve Martin. Parenthood as a kid, didn't get it. But as an adult, you're like, this is fantastic. So this is where it kind of sits for me. This is like 25 up. This for me. But the special effects, let's talk about that, because it's subtly brilliant, aren't they?
Yeah.
Robert Zemeckis, this is where Zemeckis is like the king for a lot of reasons.
I feel like you always kind of go back to, I mean, I know there's lots of really cool stuff in like Back to the Future, but I think Roger Rabbit's a real
absolutely
milestone there.
Incredible,
and
isn't
I remember it? There was like an interview with Bob Hoskins, good lord, it's too late in the day, saying that like at one point, if he held the rabbit with his fingers all together, it was fine. But if he spread like one finger, it just cost him like an extra $5,000 or something. And it's one of these things that always stuck with me about how the details matter so much in these kinds of films. And something that looks so seamless and effortless is actually a lot of work. And one of my favourite moments in Death Becomes Her is the point where after like a shovel breaks and Meryl Streep throws it and it sticks in the couch, Goldie Hawn just sits back calmly on it and it pokes up through the hole in her belly, and all I can think is I can't fathom how they did it. I know some kind of computery magic-y way, but I don't want to know.
Back in 1992, that's the most difficult thing in the entire world.
Black magic in 1992.
Yeah, even now it's like, I'm still looking at that now. That was a scene I was going to point out. Was like, it makes no sense to put a hole through somebody and then them sit through it, and also the camera pans around as she sat there, so it's not just fixed in one place. And that's the thing with Roger Rabbit as well. It wasn't just Bob Hoskins holding Roger in one place. The camera moved around him and everything was moving around. And that was what made it like super difficult. So I think it's subtly awesome that it wasn't as showy as Jurassic Park, which is still awesome. And I think that was one of the biggest things watching this time. I was just like fucking gobsmacked. Like, 1992. This is outstanding. Sorry, maybe Helen, Paul, take over.
So this time watching it, I was kind of curious. So Meryl Streep is 43 in this and Goldie Hawn is 47 in this. And like, they look like they could be in their 20s. Yeah. Like,
it is offensive.
So when they get de-aged, they kind of look like the age they looked at that time. So it's just like...
Yeah, yeah. It's a great wee trick in order to make them seem really like old. They have to like make them up to look old. So when they take the de-aging potion, they just take all the makeup off and go, right, you look like you now. It's fine.
It spans quite a long period of time, the film. There's like a time jump and then a time jump and then a massive time jump. But they still look like Goldie Hawn and Meryl Streep.
It's kind of on a weird kind of level. There's a certain degree of like, you feel like an aspect of the pacing of the film shouldn't work because it makes such bizarre time jumps. It'll spend a little bit of time here and then it'll jump 3 years and it'll this little time here, jump 5 years, little time here, jump another few years. And the bulk of the movie is over the course of a day and a night.
Yeah.
It's and then it'll do another big time and a really substantial time jump later. And yet it never feels choppy, it never feels weird, it never loses you. It just clips along, it's great.
Because Helen gets to experience her eternal youth for like about 10 years, maybe a bit longer, whereas poor old Madeline only gets to experience her eternal youth for like a couple of hours. Yeah. She barely gets home and has time to show it off before she's next broken, and that fall down the stairs is brilliant.
It's the noise.
I absolutely love that. Yeah, it's so good. Like all the crunching and skittling down, and I remember watching the first time watching it, and when she kind of like gets up, it's so brilliant and grotesque but hilarious.
Even just the way it's edited, so because they really elongate, so it makes it seem like the staircase goes on forever. Yeah. Yeah. Same at the end as well. Like these staircases are just like, they're 4 steps long, and yet it takes you forever to fall down them. It's great. It's great.
I love as well just the way some of it's framed, because there's times where they clearly like, okay, we're having a conversation here, but we want you looking at the back of the room.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's like split diopters, and other times you can tell it's because they're fudging around the special effects, so it's just a bit fuzzy, but that almost makes it creepier. There's just this thing moving in the back of the hall.
Yeah, that's the classic one where Ernest is on the phone. I did it. And suddenly Helen pops back and she starts moving around. And again,
and back in the 1970s. It's watching her get up. It's like watching Bambi learn how to walk. It's just so uncomfortable.
But like horrifying, like really janky and weird.
What rating was this when it came? Well, it must have been at least a PG. It must have been a PG, actually, because I'm not sure.
I think it was a... It's listed on Netflix as 12,
but the DVD I've got in the house is a PG, so I feel like it's one of these films that's a bit like Jaws, you know, that way every now and then a BBFC person looks at it and is like, oh no, we've been getting this one wrong for years.
There's no way I could have seen the cinema if that was a 12, not at the cinema I went to see it. But I did, for sure, because I remember I very, very much remember the actual sequences where like Madeline gets killed really well, and the shotgun projecting her into the fountain outside. Vividly remember those in a big dark room, just going, this is amazing, because it's a cartoon. It's bizarre. It's like a cartoon with consequences.
Where are you guys on Robert Zemeckis and his career as a director?
Kind of in a weird spot with him. On a certain level, like, he's technically a really, really good director. Mm. Like, pretty much seems to always make the right decisions as to, like, casting, where, what types of projects to do, where to put the camera. Has a really good sense of visual effects that he's been able to put together for a really long time. And yet, oftentimes he seems to make something that's not good. It's a weird kind of thing. We talked about it on an episode of Fatal Attractions where he very often, it seems like he made like an all-timer classic very early in his career. He made Back to the Future. And ever since then, more of a critical eye has been pointed at him than his career can necessarily bear up to. He still makes really good films every once in a while. And this is great. But there are times where you go, that's not great. And if we were less critically minded in looking at stuff, we would maybe be more forgiving. I don't know. He's
more
spotty.
Forgiving or less forgiving? I mean, looking at his filmography, well, Helen and Emma, what are your high level thoughts before I go through his filmography?
I feel like he's one of these people where sometimes he maybe gets a bit hung up on an idea, and that doesn't always translate through the whole film. Like, I feel like as much, I do love this is great, but exactly what Paul was saying about the pacing is one of the things I think's slightly weaker about the film, because it feels like somebody had the fight sequence in the middle in their head and were like, this is the film, and then there's the rest of it threaded around it, because that's the chunkiest part of the film, that whole night of the coming home, she's dead, no, now she's dead, and oh, get up and all this. And I feel like with other things, like I hated Beowulf because I really love the story of Beowulf, and it felt like one of these things where it was like, but we're making this 3D action movie of like great heroes, and it's not good.
Helen,
definitely for me, like, he kind of made the films of my childhood in terms of like the stuff in the 80s and then kind of the 90s, but then post Castaway, anything after that, I don't think I've seen. Well, I think I've probably seen Flight, but I haven't really seen that. I think some of the kind of magic that I experienced watching his earlier films just kind of isn't there. But then maybe I think, well, is he still kind of making the same films but for like the next generation of me? Like, maybe there's like younger people who are kind of into the stuff that he's doing. He did become very kind of obsessed with special effects, didn't he? And trying to recreate humans in special effects. And it kind of got in the way of a story rather than... But then I guess maybe it's who he works with, because obviously the writer of this, David, is it Coet?
Yeah.
Also wrote Jurassic Park, Spider-Man, Panic Room, First Mission Impossible. So maybe with a good story, he could still come back. But yeah, definitely like Who Framed Roger Rabbit, Forrest Gump, Back to the Future, to some extent Castaway are all great
films.
Those
are all outstanding classics. I mean, Castaway is slightly different because that's less of a special effects kind of beast in there. More because he does do these character pieces like Flight, but also there's weird ones like Allied and The Walk, where you're like, I think this is what was it you, Emma, saying about he's picked the scene and that's why he's done it. So The Walk is he's recreated that walk between the two towers, and that's why he wants to do the film, and that's pretty much the whole reason why he wants to do the film. But then the rest of it is like, I mean, the story's okay-ish, but that walk bit is, you almost wish you just did the short of that bit.
Yeah.
And then that was it. And then you go up and do your next thing. So Allied's a weird one that I wouldn't have put down in him.
We've reviewed that. I'm like, he directed that? Yeah, exactly. Did we talk about him when we reviewed it?
Exactly.
Because I'm like, what?
It's such a weird thing. Of course, we forget Romancing the Stone, which is one of the things that put him on the map.
Yeah.
Absolute class. Well, I need to rewatch it. I was going to say absolute classic, but I'm not sure how well it holds up. But he's one of those. He's a director of my youth. But to say it's a Robert Zemeckis film now isn't going to make me run to it. The most recent film of What's the Fizz was Witches, and I was like, I don't think you need to do this film. And I watched it, and I was like, you didn't need to read this film. The Nicholas Rogue one was fantastic and scared me more to death than its modern iteration.
Which I think is why I kind of avoided it. I'm a bit of a sap for a lot of like physical effects. So I think a lot of the trailers for the new Witches immediately made me go, no.
Nah, I'm not into that. Not into that at all. Is there anything else, guys, want to talk about before we head to the scores?
I think one of the things I just really love about the film as well is like the body horror element of it is brutal. Mm. And it's ultimately about really horrible things happening to women's bodies. But it doesn't ever really hold back, and quite often it's the women inflicting this on each other or themselves. Like, I think the film kind of shows super early on these women are never going to be able to look after themselves for eternity, because one of them's never out the plastic surgeon, and Helen loves ice cream, apparently. So I feel like it's one of these films where super early on they're like, these are going to look like haggard old queens by the end of the film.
That was quite shocking to me when they pulled up the veil at the end. I was like, fucking hell, that's...
Yeah. Fall asleep with your makeup on.
Yeah.
It's what happens when your fingers break off. You can't put them back on.
How can you possibly apply mascara in the same dexterity if you're missing some of your fingers?
Scores?
Sure.
I'm Sam Clements, host of the 90 Minutes or Less Film Festival, another podcast in the Stripped Media family, a podcast that celebrates movies under 90 minutes long. Each episode, I'm joined by a special guest who selects a movie to join our prestigious lineup. Past guests have come from the worlds of film, television, music, food, comedy, and podcasting. Search for us now on the app you're currently listening to this podcast, or join us at 90minfilmfest.com.
Welcome to the Flixwatcher scores. All of our scores are out of five. You may have decimal places if you wish. And we'll start with you, please, Emma, with your recommendability.
I'm going to say five because it's great. I think it kind of fits everything. It's a comedy. It's got some really weird horror element. It's quite a good gateway horror film for maybe young horror fans. Plus the cast. And if you want to see Bruce Willis just being a total shaking wreck, this is the one to do it.
Paul?
I'll go quite high, maybe not quite as high as Emma. I'll probably go with four because it is a lot of fun. There are maybe some things that would maybe sort of drop against some people because some people might find it too cartoonish until they can't really sort of dig into it, or maybe they'll find the pacing of it, but it is a good fun time, and it is kind of watching a sea of incredibly talented actors just run with it.
So four, Helen.
I'm so happy you picked this, Emma. I think this film is brilliant, and I really like what you say about it being kind of like a gateway horror, because I definitely feel as though it was a gateway horror, or at least kind of gateway sort of comedy horror as well. But I think it's brilliant. I think there's a lot in it for kind of everyone, really. And even for kind of a serious film fan, it's such an interesting performance by Meryl Streep, because she kind of hasn't really done anything at all like this. And it's just a fascinating piece of cinema from that kind of time as well. And it's so, there's some like wonderfully campy moments, like the songbird song that she has at the start is just ridiculously off the chart camp. It's brilliant. Like, you could almost imagine like some kind of like musical coming out of this or something. I think it's,
I feel
just
like some drag performers have totally embraced this, right? Like Jinx and Dandelion
from
Drag Race have both done bits and pieces.
It's just timeless. So yeah, absolutely a 5 from me.
Hey, I'm going to go for 4.1. I think it needs a not 12-year-old Kirby and Anatta with us. But after that, if you're for a bit of fun, then absolutely. But yeah, I don't see this as a PG film whatsoever, just because the subject matter. But I think some of the scenes are quite frantic. I do want to ask my dad, like, he will not remember taking us to see this film at all. But what were you thinking, Dad, when that was going through your mind when this lady's head was getting smacked 360 degrees and like, a spear was being thrown through her body? Although it did take us to see Jurassic Park as well, which was around this kind of time, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Sorry, Emma, repeat viewing score.
I'd probably say a 4, because it feels like the kind of film you could probably watch drunk and a Friday with a pizza and not mind that you've either missed half of it or you've seen it before. But also it's got that kind of fun thing where, because you know it a bunch, you probably could say it line for line. Plus there are, every now and then I do notice something extra in it. Like this time around watching it, I noticed them when they were in the plastic surgery right at the beginning, before anything remotely horror-y's happened. There's just a room where there's somebody, and I don't know what's happening, but it looks like they're getting some kind of like weird blood transfusion, and it's horrible. It's really weird, and I've never clocked that before. So I'd put repeat viewing up at, what did I just say, a 4? I'll say 4.
Paul?
Yeah, I'll probably put this at 4. Like, there's a reason that this movie gets, like, in some circles, this movie is the type of movie that gets screenings where people come along and say the entire script along with the, it's exactly like, you know, like the kind of camp cult classic that brings people together. It's exactly the kind of thing that if you saw when you were a kid, you maybe, it's not necessarily the same level as other ones that everyone else saw, and so you've got that kind of connective tissue with your entire generation. Maybe you saw it and you take it with you for a very long time until you meet someone else who had the same reaction to it, and then you've got a friend. Then you've got a friend for a long time because you've got something to wrap around. And yeah, this is exactly the kind of thing that you can just wrap yourself up in a bunch and rewatch over and over again without feeling the drag of it. You can let it wash over you, or you can dig into it with every one of your teeth. It's good stuff. So actually, screw it, 4.5.
Helen?
So like, I saw this like loads as a kid, like absolutely loved it, and then didn't acquire it on any kind of like DVD replacement. So it definitely came to Netflix around about a year ago, because I was like, oh, I definitely want to revisit this. And I watched it then and really enjoyed it, and equally enjoyed rewatching it this time around. And if someone said, like, do you want to watch it? I'd be like, yeah, of course I would. Why not? So 4.5. Yeah.
I don't think I'm going to watch it often. I'm giving it a 2.5. I think once every 5 years would be good for me. Like I say, I appreciate it more as an adult than as a 12-year-old in the cinema. Small screen score. Let's go for Emma.
I had a weird thing about this where when I watched it on Netflix, and it might have been, I don't think it was my monitor, but it just felt a little fuzzy. And I ended up switching the DVD, and the DVD was better quality. So I don't know whether Netflix has like blown it up to fit the ratio or something, because the DVD ratio was weird. But I would love to see this on like a cult screen at night at the cinema, as exactly Paul was saying, like everybody kind of cheering lines along, and you know, and it's so quotable that I think it'd be great for that, the whole I'll paint your ass, you paint mine. Yeah, so yeah, small screen score 2.
Ooh, Paul,
there's definitely something in this that kind of begs for a big screen, even just aside from like the watching it with a crowd of similarly minded people, there's something about it that's, given that it's so like highly camp, and it's about incredibly large as life characters who are grasping for like immortality and glamour and like that shit, begs for a big screen to just to have them fill it. I mean, like the Meryl Streep musical number in and of itself demands height, scale. So you can still enjoy it on a small screen for sure, but there's definitely something in there that, you know, demands big screen. I'll give it 3 on a small screen.
Helen?
I'm going to have to like ask my dad if we went to see it at the cinema, because I'm like, I can't think that far back. Too much new stuff has entered my brain and it's...
Push the other stuff out.
Yeah, I definitely saw it like a lot around the time it came out. I'd love to see it again at the cinema. Like you said, I think watching it with an audience who loves it as much as we do would be a great experience. But then that kind of said, if you've kind of seen it enough times at home, then it's kind of enjoyable. And if your only option is to see it on Netflix, then do that, because it's kind of fun. So I'm going to give it a 4.
I'm going to give it a... I'm going to give it a 2.5 again, because I think next time I do watch it, it would be a Prince Charles screening with lots of people there, because I think I need to get the oomph and the energy from the crowd. Plus, because again, special effects just they still blew my mind. Absolutely seamless. So I'd like to see it on a big screen again next. Engagement score, Emma.
I'm going to be very predictable and say 5. I feel like it just has me from start to finish. I feel like I'm invested in these women from the word go. As we've already said, big musical number. Plus, it's just the idea that from the beginning, it's so clear they hate each other. And you spend the whole film just wanting to know why. And why do you hate each other? And then by the time you know why they hate each other, it's so stupid and ridiculous that you now want to see that their idea of hell has been stuck together forever. So, yeah, totally 5. Plus, it's the idea as well. It's this total scathing critique of like Hollywood and the expectations put on particularly women. So it just feels like it's constantly like making a Hollywood movie while at the same time like jabbing you in the ribs about it. So yeah, 5 for me.
Paul?
I shall say 4 because I do love it. But it does have me pretty much from beginning to end. I guess there are times where I can sort of... I think I'll maybe start paying attention to like different smaller aspects of it. I'll like look at the effects, or I'll look at color, or I'll look at something that's maybe something that's part of a minutia of it rather than the entity of it itself. So I don't know if that is necessarily I don't know if that makes it more engaging, or if that's an aspect of it, me being distracted by a smaller part of it. But yeah, I'll say 4.
Helen?
It's kind of a weird one, because obviously I've seen it so many times that obviously I know everything that's coming up, but I'm still really engaged in it because I just really enjoy spending time with this film. And, you know, an hour and 43 minutes, I think any longer, it didn't need, like, there's no way it needed to be any longer. And it works for me, so I'm going to go 5 as well.
Fair enough. I'm going to go for a 4. I think those time jumps actually really helped kind of propel the film. And was it when Goldie Hawn was in the... I don't know the most appropriate word to say, the institution. Did we go to see Meryl Streep and Ernest at that point? Or was it just literally focused on her for that like 5 minutes and then went to another time jump? So it's kind of interesting how, as you say, how it kind of bounced around. And we kind of have hide nor hair of prosthetically overweight Goldie Hawn.
I mean, they
Goldie
wouldn't
Hawn
be able to make
now.
It now with a fat suit, would they? No. I mean, let's face it.
I don't know if they would, because they're kind of proving a point that she's gone so downhill. I don't know. Wouldn't you to be able to use it objectively, but they could use a fat suit to show that someone was fat and then they lost weight for legitimate reasons, but not to show that she's just a mess.
I do feel now watching it, it's slightly problematic that one of them, her self-destructive thing is she just keeps getting facelifts, and the other one is that she clearly has mental health issues and then eats a lot. Yeah. So, I feel like you kind of have to watch it with that moment where your brain switched on so that you can go, it's not okay. I'm glad we've moved past this.
Yeah, yeah. As much as it's making the point about the change of like women's bodies and the representation in Hollywood, it's kind of still doing that in and of itself.
Yeah.
So it keeps me engaged. Let's go for 4.1 again. And that gives us an overall score of 3.95000. It's up there. It's deep. It's good. it was a small screen score, which is, you know, Bob Robert Zemeckis' sci-fi special that's let it down with a 2.87 overall small screen score, but everything else is pretty high. Cheers, guys, for bringing us film. Emma, what is yours specifically?
It's a good fun one.
It must be fun, like, taking on films which weren't featured in any of your podcasts.
Yeah, that was quite refreshing. I don't know if Paul feels the same. I did have a moment where I said to Paul, how on brand do you think we should be? And then I came back to him with the films I was going to pick, and he was like, that's still you on brand.
Yeah, it's still you. I mean, I picked ones that are me. It's just of a different kind.
Well, thank you very much. Can you tell everyone who's listening where we can find you online? And we'll say goodbye.
Sure. We are on all the things at Yearbook Podcast, Twitter, Instagram and all that. And you can catch us an email, yearbookpodcast@gmail.com.
And if you wanted to speak to either of us for some reason, I'm at Paul Cinephile and she's at Girl at Gotham.
Excellent. Been an absolute pleasure to have you guys here. Thank you very much for choosing Death Becomes Her Again.
Thank you for having us and letting us gush about this film.
Thank you so much for picking it and joining us tonight.
Yeah. Awesome. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye.
Enjoyed this episode of FlixWatcher Podcast? Why not leave us a 5-star review on iTunes? You can also follow us at FlixWatcherPod on Twitter, and we're at FlixWatcher on Instagram. Thanks as always to the Mighty People for their mighty, mighty tunes, and Ben from Rockwood Audio for his awesome editing skills. If you're looking to get your podcast edited as sweet as this, get in touch with Ben, and that's Rockwood, R-O-K-K Wood Audio. Tell him FlixWatcher sent you.
You just heard a Stripped Media production.